Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking hour?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome to Upfront. I'm Chloe Morgan.
And I'm Regina Sullivan.
Chelsea got the better of Arsenal on Friday night and they worked their socks off. Get it? What? But the less said about socks, the better. We look back on a huge win for Chelsea in the title race. Emma Hayes' comments about relationships in women's football before the game made lots of headlines too. So we're also going to reflect on that and the wider discourse on relationships between players and between players and coaches right now. Finally, we also preview the return of Women's Football Weekend, where there are two juicy derbies to tuck into. Hi, Rach. Hello,
Hi.
How have you been? How's life?
It's been good. Not much to talk about this week, is there?
Oh, God, such a boring one.
Happy St. Patrick's Day, by the way, for yesterday.
Happy St. Paddy's Day. I didn't even message you. I'm so sorry.
Didn't.
I should have thought.
Your token Irish friend.
I was out having a roast, yeah, thinking about all the things, you know, British roast, to be honest. yeah, do apologise. Right, before we get stuck into all the juicy bits from the weekend, what has been your moment of the weekend?
Do you know what I really enjoyed? My mum came to visit this weekend. And
cute. For St. Patrick's Day.
Well, she was going to come for Mother's Day weekend, and it was bloody extortionate. So she came for St. Patrick's Day instead. So, yeah, she came for the weekend, and I was very lucky to be given tickets by three to the match on Friday. So I got to bring my mum to watch Chelsea Arsenal in a box, and she had a wonderful time. And that was a really nice moment for me this weekend.
Oh, my God, that's super, super cute. Super cute. And that the three box, I mean, I think we've been there a couple of times ourselves, yeah.
We did a great interview with Niamh Charles in that box, just in case anyone's missed it. Like, by all means, after this episode, go back and listen to it, because it was wonderful. But yes, the box is lovely.
Oh, that's such a heartwarming moment.
What about you?
I also have quite a heartwarming moment. Kansas City Currents' Alex Pfeiffer became the youngest goal scorer in NWSL history in a thriller on Saturday. 16 years, 3 months and 20 days old. She beat the previous record for the youngest goal scorer set by Thorns' Olivia Moultrie in 2022. She came on as a second half substitute and scored. And like,
that game was wild. Wasn't there a couple of records broken in that? That game, like goals scored, and
it was a wild game. Like, I thought I caught some of the highlights, but yeah, I mean, could you imagine at 16 years old? Like, she's I'm like literally double her age and some. That's crazy. So
the other thing about the NWSL, we have to say their kits.
Oh,
some of those kits are unreal.
I mean, what they've created at Kansas City Current is, it's just the most beautiful vibe. Like, I mean, that I think
stadium.
We need more of that. Ugh. Like, we see that with Arsenal and some of their fantastic kits, you know, the TFL collabs, the Stella McCartney collabs and stuff. But bring that vibe over here. I mean, Everton could do with a bit of a revamp of their
Everton
kits,
did but a lovely little Irish-themed kind of shamrocky shirt that I saw the other day ahead of St. Patrick's Day. And sadly, there wasn't any left for me. But
you're
that
just going to go and
nice
buy an
vibe.
Everton shirt?
Well, I just really like the St. Patrick's Day vibe, man.
Wow.
Just really wanted it. It was a nice one for the collection. I've got some cool ones from the collection. Do you remember Man City did one for Emmeline Pankhurst International Women's Day? I think
yes,
it was a couple
yes.
of seasons ago.
Yeah.
Lovely, lovely kit that was.
Wild.
Very nice.
Well, I think now that we've got this sort of rebranding happening with Nuko, that's what I'd like to see as the future of the WSL. More of these kind of like collab fancy, like sparky kits. Like, just bring
do you know
on.
What it might, do you know what it might prevent?
Go on.
Sock clash.
Oh, what a great segue. Absolutely congratulations. Well done on that. I really, really appreciate that one. That's two out of two really now that you've done that. Right, let's get stuck in then. Chelsea beat Arsenal. And not just, I thought it was going to be a close game. A lot of people thought it was going to be a close game. We're expecting a little bit more of a hotter competition, but it was not to be. 3-1 on Friday night under the lights to put Chelsea 6 points ahead in the title race. As Rach alluded to, another slight hiccup, another administrative faux pas, kickoff delayed by 30 minutes after Arsenal brought out the wrong socks. And this kind of only came about sort of a couple of minutes before the kickoff, leading to Arsenal having to scurry around trying to find where was going to be open at 7 o'clock on a Friday night. Eventually ended up buying the socks from Black Socks from Chelsea's club shops.
They were blue. They were like their dark blue socks.
But the worst thing about it is they kind of had to then duct tape up the Chelsea label. And obviously, as they're running around, the labels are like flying off left, right and centre, exposing the Chelsea brand on the Arsenal players' calves. And you're just thinking, I thought we'd passed this point. How silly. How naive.
It was, you'd be absolutely bleeding mortal, wouldn't you? Like, imagine being the kit man being like, guys. I think the most frustrating part for me about all of this was Arsenal were bloody warming up in that kit and those socks. You could see it the whole time, and only when they came in the tunnel someone was like, hang on, something's not right here. So like, it's bad enough you brought the wrong socks and then nobody friggin' spotting it until they're literally about to step out on the pitch is pretty poor form. It's a blunder, it's a misstep, it's embarrassing, it's pretty funny. It's not the end of the fucking world, all right? I saw some people out there being like, oh, this is bringing the game into disrepute. And you're like, lads, chill out. It's a pair of friggin' socks. It's, you know, it's like when a female commentator makes a mistake and then everyone goes, this is why women shouldn't play commentate on football. And you're like, guys, it's a mistake. It's shit. Everyone's embarrassed. It shouldn't happen. It did. It's fine.
My God.
It's pretty
Send
funny. It's pretty funny.
Prayers for the kid person. I can't imagine the level of anxiety and
it's
fear.
It's like Monday morning HR going, you have a meeting with HR this morning. Can you please come in on Monday? Oh no, just, we hope you're okay.
It happens. Kit man, like, let's not associate this small faux pas with it being like a wider women's football issue. I've absolutely got to agree. But I mean, it doesn't help that people like, I mean, obviously former Arsenal striker Ian Wright posted on Twitter, embarrassing this, ridiculous. Yeah, so I don't think it helps sort of adding or trying to reduce the kind of fire from this whole situation, but we move.
Listen, I was at the Yeovil game in 2017. I was there when Liverpool trotted out in Yeovil's away kit because they hadn't brought the kit, the right kit. They'd gotten a new sponsor literally that week and they hadn't brought the right kit. So they had to trot out and play Yeovil in Yeovil's full away kit. So that's definitely worse than socks.
Things could be worse. But yeah, I think it was obviously it was more heightened because there were so many people attending the game. I mean, 32,970 fans were in attendance, which is a record for Stamford Bridge. Well done. Yeah, honestly, a record for Chelsea women at Stamford Bridge. So obviously not just, you know, across the board. But yeah, I think, and obviously Karen Carney was then sort of saying, you know, it could have happened at maybe
King's Meadow.
You know, one of the games that they haven't had that many people there. But yeah, it was a great start to things. But yeah, let's get stuck into the game because it was probably for a marquee fixture of that size, of that magnitude, it's going to be the big matchup. You're just wondering whether Arsenal are sort of, you know, going to keep themselves in this title race situation. But then Chelsea are 3-0 up after just half an hour and you think things aren't going to plan. I mean, Rach, you were there. What were your thoughts sort of watching that first 30 minutes?
I was like, what the hell is going on? This is not what I expected. Yeah, I was hoping for a closer match, a big clash, you know, clash of the giants, top of the table. We'd seen Arsenal pull out some big performances in front of big crowds at the Emirates. You kind of thought it'd be a similar vibe. Obviously had that 4-1 win earlier on in the season. And probably arguably the best moment for Arsenal to play Chelsea, given Chelsea are missing Myra Ramirez, Mia Fischel, Sam Kerr, Natalie Bjorn, Millie Bright,
Mielda, you know, Mielda, and Katrin Berger.
You know,
the list goes on.
It does. And look, Chelsea do have depth. But when you're putting Cheryska Nuskin as your number nine, who is a revelation, by the way, this player, it's a Rolls Royce of a player. If you can go, come here, can you just go, I know you're normally midfield, but do you mind going to centre back there for a couple of games? Actually, could you go up number nine now this weekend? And she's like, yeah, no bother, I'll score a brace, one of them with my arse. Like, she was a revelation. I think Arsenal felt like they were still in the bloody dressing room looking for socks, to be honest. Whether that actually had played a part in any of the mind games, I don't know. But they weren't at the races. They didn't start well. Chelsea did.
I didn't think they had a bad start, though. I mean, they kind of looked a little bit sprightly. A couple of like decent chances. The Kim Little strike. There was a Catley strike as well. A couple of quite easy, you know, bog standard saves for Hannah Hampton. But
okay,
recorded some shots on target.
Okay. Well done. But I just felt like the intensity that Chelsea started with, Arsenal didn't quite manage to match or kind of keep up with. So I think that was probably quite frustrating for them. I think Nuskin in that number nine probably threw Lotta and Leah off a little bit. It gave them something to think about, something they didn't know they were going to have to contend with and arguably how to deal with because, you know, they haven't had her in a number nine in that position before. Probably gave LJ just that little bit more freedom then because the two L's were kind of L squared were too focused on what Nuskin was doing. So LJ is just a different, you don't think she can reach another level and then you put her on the Stamford Bridge pitch and she just reaches another level every time. And I feel like an LJ goal at Stamford Bridge, you're pretty much guaranteed at this rate.
Well, it's where she excels. It feels like she sort of, like you said, like comes alive. And this is an interesting one because this is also, Emma Hayes has won every single WSL game she's managed at Stamford Bridge. It's also the most played fixture in the WSL ever. So there was 10 wins apiece for Chelsea and Arsenal up until this game.
Oh,
so
wow.
This was kind of like the decider game, the 21st game. But yeah, getting back to LJ, the 14th minute goal, I mean, let's talk about that. It was beautiful. I mean, Arsenal dispossessed in midfield. One ball threaded through, completely cut apart the Arsenal defence. It just seemed they were completely blindsided, out of place, just not, like you said, at the races. Cuts inside, cuts back outside, powerful shot. And let's talk about the Manuela Zinsberger save / error. So she basically, I mean, it's a cracking shot. I mean, I'd love to know what the pace is on that shot, because it does almost take her hands off. The angle, she's in the right position. Absolutely. I was looking at her footwork going back over it, and she's in the right position, but it doesn't hit her palms. It kind of hits her wrist. And I think sometimes that is the stronger part, because obviously, like, if your palms, and it's that kind of shot, like, you do have a little bit of a fear that the speed of the ball is going to take it past you. But I don't necessarily criticise her for the goal, even though it looks like a more embarrassing goal than I think is. I think it is just that the deflection of the ball off of her wrist, and then I think it just spins in a really unfortunate way and goes back into the goal. I mean, if you tried to recreate that again, you absolutely couldn't. But I am not actually that critical, but Rach, you look a little bit more dubious of the situation.
Well, I mean, you're the expert, so if you're saying it's almost easier to do than we think it is, then I'm going to take your word for it. But looking at it at the time, you're thinking, surely she's done something wrong there with the positioning of her hands and the ball is able to go up and over. But you're telling me that that's not the case. So I'm going to bow down to your goalkeeping expertise. But at the time, I did think, yeah, she should have done better, because you just wonder, should the ball be going up when you save it? You know, it could literally go any other direction, either side of you or back out. I mean, you don't want to go back to LJ. But yeah, just the up and over would have been frustrating, and watching the players desperately try and scramble to get behind her and clear the lines. It just looked calamitous, yeah.
Because the Arsenal defenders are kind of getting back, and then she almost stops thinking that the Arsenal defenders are going to go. I can't remember who it was that's sort of like closest to the ball, but they try and like almost hook the ball out of the net, and she's kind of like standing there just waiting for them to do it, because otherwise they just would have clashed into each other. So it did look a bit, and I don't want to do the Benny Hill thing over again, but it did look a bit kind of like,
yeah,
oh guys, someone just get a foot to it. But I think maybe it sort of, it attracts more criticism because it's Zinsberger, and she has fantastic games, these incredible saves, and then she does something that sort of everyone's like, that was a really critical key moment, and the error is so obvious that you think it could have, well, it has defined the game. That was the kind of, okay, well, Chelsea are now totally on the front foot. But
if, for you as a goalkeeper, if you know the ball is going in, do you dive anyway? So that's, I think, what maybe frustrates people, is that it's almost like sometimes Zinsberger's like, I know this has me beat. And she'll just watch it, and you're like, mate, just throw yourself at it. Like, look like you're going for it, because it just looks worse to not do that.
Dramatic.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. All day I've had saves like that where I'm like, I don't know whether I could have got it or not. I'll have to watch it back in the analysis, but I probably should have looked like I was doing more instead of just, you know, resigned myself to defeat. But yeah, I think errors like that do kind of make you feel like, okay, well, it's interesting now that we're kind of hearing these rumours and reports coming in that Arsenal are sort of interested in signing someone like Daphne Van Domselaar. Obviously, a ridiculously young, very talented keeper. It looks like everything, all the sort of Earps rumours have completely subsided, and that doesn't seem to be going everywhere. But she's obviously at Villa at the moment, having a fantastic season with them. And Villa are doing relatively well, but at the same time,
I mean, they concede a lot of goals, but they also face a lot of shots.
It's that. I mean, she's had 14 appearances with them, but they are bottom four for goals conceded. But when you look at the kind of calibre of performances that she's capable of, I mean, in the Netherlands, like the World Cup was absolutely outstanding. I mean, yeah, do you think that could be a good, if they can stump up the £200,000 release clause, which I'm sure they probably have in their budget. Do you think that would be a good signing for them?
It'd be a good signing. And I think it's no secret that Arsenal have been looking for another goalkeeper, and you also have to factor that into Manuela Zinsberger's performances, because she's having to deal with that knowledge that Arsenal are desperately out looking for a goalkeeper, and it's all anyone's talking about. So you kind of have to factor that in as well for her and her performances. And when, you know, and credit to her in the second half, Zinsberger, she was fantastic in the second half. So, you know, there's a lot she has to contend with as well. But yeah, I think Van Domselaar would be a good signing. I think Carla Ward would be absolutely raging if she lost her. But yeah, she'd be good, I think, for Arsenal, especially getting in a young keeper.
Oh my God, well, that seems to be the trend, doesn't it, at the moment? Hannah Hampton, Daphne Van Domselaar, Kiara Keating, they're just getting younger and younger. And I feel sorry for people like, I don't know, Courtney Brosnan, or
great. Don't worry about her.
Mackenzie Arnold, just thinking,
so
oh
she.
God, like
she was unreal.
Oh my God, yeah, they're absolutely unreal. I'm not detracting away from their performances, but just saying, my God, they seem to be getting 20 years younger, these keepers. That's what, that would be my fear anyway. Right, the last time these two sides met, Arsenal absolutely nullified Lauren James out of the game, but this time she was subbed off late to a standing ovation. I mean,
How do we feel like the relationship, or the fans' relationship, I suppose, with Lauren James has changed? And what has she done to kind of, I don't know, rectify, obviously, you know, some not particularly great behaviour in some of the previous games?
I don't know. I think she's always had a good relationship with fans. I think the Chelsea fans have always backed LJ, and they've always been really receptive and responsive to her. They know they've got an absolute gem of a player, a world-class player. And Emma Hayes spoke about managing someone like Lauren James and how she always does well with kind of the Mavericks. And LJ is that. She's this really unique talent that needs to get the right management to get the best out of her, like any brilliant, brilliant player. And I think she has a really good relationship with Emma Hayes as well, which I think has massively helped. You know, she didn't have loads of pressure on her as soon as she joined. Emma Hayes is very good at kind of managing players into the team, if you know what I mean. And I think that's why she's become the player she's become. She's still young, so of course we're going to see flashpoints in her career. But when she's on that Stamford Bridge stage, and it's lovely for like a player that's Chelsea through and through to see them flourish on that stage. It's like when you see, I don't know, when Leah Williamson stepped onto the Emirates with 60,000 people there, you know, it's those moments where you see a Chelsea, like a true Chelsea player, mm-hmm. performing at their home club. I think this statistic still stands that she is the men or women Chelsea player has scored the most goals at Stamford Bridge this season.
I think that still stands. Yeah.
Yeah. And you think, you compare how many games Chelsea women have played at Stamford Bridge versus the Chelsea men's team. It's an incredible stat. She's had two hat tricks, I think, there as well. So yeah, it's pretty special. And these moments are important for her as well to get the experience of performing on the big stage and turning up when it matters. And like, they all just kind of, she'll bank them. And next time she comes up in a difficult game or whatever, she can draw on that experience. So exciting times, I'd say, for Chelsea fans who have, yeah, I think always had her back.
Well, let's flip things over slightly then to the other end of the pitch. I'd have all went for Stina Blackstenius up front after her hat-trick in the win over Villa. But she was hooked off at half-time for Alessia Russo. Yeah, I mean, I thought that she was having a relatively okay game. And I don't think Alessia Russo coming on made any kind of significant impact. It just feels like it was a flat performance all round, and no one could kind of, there was no leadership there to kind of like step it up and sort of bring themselves back into it. But I mean, do we think this was all round just kind of Arsenal underperforming and sort of not giving, you know, Russo, Blackstenius, the opportunity to kind of excel? Or do we think actually that was just all round, top to bottom, just a bit of a nightmare?
I think everyone had an off day. I don't think it was that Blackstenius was good or bad, or Alessia Russo was better or worse. I think tactically it was maybe the wrong decision to start Blackstenius. Part of me wonders if Jonas Eideveld thought Chelsea were going to be more compact, like we saw maybe against Manchester City or against mm-hmm. Everton. And he thought maybe she'd be the right player to try and get between the lines or getting over the back. I think Russo, in the way that Chelsea played, maybe would have been the better option in hindsight, because, you know, matching her up against Buchanan, she's good at going back and getting the ball. I think there was a lack of service for Blackstenius as well. So I think Russo's very good at going back and getting the ball. And I think sometimes when opportunities did fall, they kind of maybe fell to the wrong person who wasn't quite in the form that, like, there was almost a one-on-one with Caitlin Ford, and she's not been as good as she has been in the past. And you just think maybe if that was something that would fell to maybe a Russo, who'd have more confidence in that moment or whatever. So I think all round, maybe a flat performance from the team. But I also just think tactically, maybe Jonas got it wrong. And I think I've spoken about this before on the pod, where Jonas Eideveld is one of those where he sometimes can absolutely tactically out masterclass and out tactics another manager, and other times he completely fumbles it. And I think I've said that he sometimes focuses too much on what the other team are going to do. And it was funny because Sophie messaged me before saying that he spent like 90%, she tweeted it, about 90% of the warm-up watching Chelsea. And like, she was like, well, look, fair enough, maybe he's just trying to figure out what they're going to, I'm like, if he's still trying to figure out what they're going to do, you're not going to get that across to your players by the time you go back into the changing rooms. Maybe that's why they lost the socks, because he was like, shit, we need another 30 minutes. I'm joking. But like, that for me is kind of a bit of an indicator where I don't even think Emma Hayes comes out and watches the warm-ups. Do you know what I mean? It's like, she's like, I've prepped my team the best I can, you know. And I just thought that was an interesting point, the fact that he was out watching the warm-up so intently, watching the opposition team warm-up so intently, I thought was quite interesting. So I just think tactically, Hayes nailed it.
Weirdly enough, I used to do that. So towards the end of like the session, the warm-up sessions, because the goalkeepers normally go in sort of about 5 or 10 minutes earlier than the outfield players. Obviously, we come out earlier. I don't actually know why that is. Well, I kind of do. Like, you kind of get a little bit more time just to settle yourself, get into your own head in the change room. You have that moment by yourself. But also, like, I used to spend that 5 minutes just having a look. Because at the end of the opposition's kind of training sessions, like the warm-up time, they would be doing sort of their, I don't know, like shooting drills and things like that. So it was always just really interesting to see who was on form, who was missing, who was going for, like, the power shots, who was going for placement at that point, like, who was kind of feeding in, who was being the delivery player, like, that kind of thing. So I kind of rate it to a certain extent, but that was me as a goalkeeper just looking for like the, it's not me as a manager trying to think, do we need to be tweaking our tactics like 30 seconds before the game?
Maybe he wasn't doing that, but I just think it's interesting. And I think sometimes a lot of managers will talk about, we need to focus on what we're doing and what we can control in our game plan. And sometimes it's a bit of a, you might get caught up in what the other team are doing too much. And I did ask Emma Hayes this in the press conference beforehand about, we saw this with them in Champions League, particularly that year where they got to the final, and they always improved on the second leg. And that, I find that's often the case with Chelsea generally, not always, but they will improve on the second leg of a game. If they lose a game the second time they play, they're generally better. And I feel like we saw that. But at the same time, very different setup to when they played each other last time as well, when you factor in injuries and whatnot.
I think it's obviously they got their consolation goal. I mean, it was a bit of a fluky consolation goal, if that's anything. But now I feel like it's kind of evenly matched. Like, both sides have embarrassed each other on the other one's home soil, so it kind of feels like, okay, well, maybe it was just the world balancing itself.
Called a draw. Yeah.
Yeah. But do we think now, then, given that loss, 6 points behind Chelsea and Man City in the title race, do we think that they're now well and truly out of it?
Yeah, I think
there's absolutely no chance in hell that Arsenal are going to suddenly deliver this really incredible comeback, unless Chelsea and Man City completely drop off form.
That's what I was going to say. Arsenal could win every game. It doesn't matter.
It's that. Chelsea I'm a little bit more concerned about, but we'll get into that later on in the pod.
And look, we said this when they lost to West Ham. We said, you know what? They're out of it. They're not going to do it. But then Chelsea had to play Man City. You know, anything's possible. It's still feasibly possible. But it's not just the, can Arsenal actually win every game between now and the end of the season? It's also, are Man City and Chelsea both going to drop enough points for us to come back into it? And the two things just both don't look likely.
Absolutely not. Well, you had a good crack. You had a good crack, Arsenal. We had high expectations. I predicted you as the WSL title winners this year. That wasn't correct. But we move. And there's still Champions League football to play for. That looks like a fairly good consolation prize for
this
season.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves, shall we?
Oh, don't.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know.
And then we're way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Right, let's get stuck into a slightly controversial, very sensitive topic. In the build-up to this game, Emma Hayes caused a little bit of a storm with her comments about relationships between players in her pre-match press conference. She was asked about relationships between coaches and players, which of course came after Willie Kirk was recently suspended by Leicester over his alleged relationship with a player in his squad. As everyone's sort of seen a few months previously, Sheffield United manager Jonathan Morgan was also sacked last month after it emerged he'd had a relationship with a player at a previous club. Hayes called both player-coach relationships and player-to-player relationships inappropriate, saying that player relationships within the same team presents challenges and that she believes the professional game should move past these places, suggesting it was perhaps a bit of a hangover from the women's game shifting from an amateur game into a professional game. It's sort of that the inappropriate word in itself was kind of, you know, quite
inappropriate
to say, but then that kind of escalated a bit more because Jess Carter was then seen liking posts criticizing Hayes and her remarks. But then after the Arsenal game, Hayes kind of almost wanted to apologize for what was said. She didn't think it was the right term to use that word. It's all sort of it's a storm in a teacup, essentially. There's kind of two aspects to it. There's the player-manager relationship situation, and then there's player-player. So I think we'll probably start with the player-manager situation because me and Rach were kind of saying, you know, before the pod started, there was a lot of press at a lot of the press conferences this week, obviously off the back of the news about Willie Kirk. You know, a lot of people were really interested in getting the manager's comments on, you know, what their positions were and how they felt about that situation. It's a kind of unusual one in a way because I think everyone was sort of very much on the same page in saying, you know, player manager relationships are always going to be inappropriate. There's always going to be a risk of potentially abuse. There's always going to be a risk of, you know, things being, you know, behavior becoming untowards, or, you know, when you look at the kind of dynamic that creates between players and managers, players are always going to be in a position, especially in the women's game, where pay isn't great, where contracts are really short, that you are, there's always going to be that kind of, I don't know, it's a safeguarding issue. It's a massive safeguarding issue. And I just think it was nice to see that everyone was on the same page. But at the same time, I think there's this kind of feeling that there is also different ways in which relationships can be created in that sphere, maybe in the past, that the game is transitioning, I suppose, in terms of the professionalisation of the game as well and sort of where we're now in.
Yeah, I think quite a few of the managers are very good on it. Carla Ward was really good. Lauren Smith was really good. Robert Villaham, Matt Beard. Some clubs didn't really want to touch on it, which I thought was interesting. I thought we were all kind of, everyone was kind of on the same page in terms of the game is professional now. These safeguarding elements need to be in the game. You know, many kind of saying it was one of those unwritten rules that you don't do that, and also kind of there were follow-up questions about whether it should be included in the club's contracts and stuff like that, and they all kind of agreed that yes, it should be, but if it's not, it's not a way of saying, oh well, it wasn't in the wasn't there, so it's fine. They were all kind of saying it's an unwritten thing, you don't do it. Some of them going as far and saying it should be a sackable offence. So I thought some of them were really, really strong on it, which is right. You know, it was in every press conference, and I think, you know, something that press officers and managers could have prepped for. So I'm glad that most of them did. I think maybe the frustrating thing with the Emma Hayes press conference was that the player-to-player relationship wasn't something that was brought up. She brought that up within her answer. And I think, you know, she did come back out and clarify what she meant. She recognised that what she said was wrong and she shouldn't have used the term inappropriate, etc. Because I think we can all look back at their recruitment, and it's obviously not that big of an issue for Chelsea if you're going to be recruiting Pernilla Harder when you've got Magda Eriksson in the team. You know what I mean? So it was wrong to bring it up, because I don't think we can conflate player-manager relationships where there's a clear power dynamic that can be exploited versus player-to-player relationships, which is something that is prevalent in the women's game but also celebrated in the women's game, and something that we're all quite proud of and use as an example to show how open this game can be. I thought it was really interesting. Matt Beard in his press conference said 1 in 5 people meet their partner in the workplace. And that's quite that's a fact, you know. So that's, this is a workplace. This isn't, player-to-player relationships is not something that's a hangover in the women's game or prevalent in the game going amateur to professional. It's not exclusive to women's football. You know, relationships in the workplace happen everywhere. And it's something that I'm sure poses challenges for managers, but it's why you put, I'm sure lots of places have, if you're going to have peer-to-peer relationships, you know, let us know. Or, you know, you can totally account for that and it's going to happen. But yeah, it's just not the same as player-manager. Completely different power dynamic. And yeah, it opens the doors for a lot of potential issues with how those relationships come about, how those power dynamics can influence things. And it's not, we can all agree, not right. And I think that was clear from all the managers' press conference this week.
Yeah, absolutely. I think mainly the focus has been on the sort of player-to-player relationship comments. And I think it was a sort of a slightly unusual term to use, given the fact that, you know, Chelsea have had a number of player-to-player relationships, successful ones in the squad.
That they've celebrated.
Yeah, and it just kind of feels like, well, I can kind of understand. I know a lot of people are quite outspoken about it, saying, you know, there's nothing kind of wrong with player-to-player relationships. Obviously, Jess Carter was sort of, you know, semi-vocal, I suppose, in the way that she chose to like certain posts. And there was a really good article, actually, that Katie Wyatt wrote. She spoke to Helen Richardson-Walsh, who's the former Team GB field hockey captain, who made history in 2016 when her and her wife became the first same-sex married couple to win the Olympic gold medal together.
Love that.
And she wrote, I think Helen was sort of saying, you know, that player-to-player relationships aren't inappropriate. That's the wrong term to use. You know, we navigated this situation, you know, really sensitively, but she can understand, obviously, that there are challenges. And I think for me personally, you know, I have kind of been in setups and had experiences where, you know, I've been a part of teams in the past where, you know, players have had relationships and everything's been fine. You go out on nights out and things and, you know, you support, you know, both of the people. But naturally, I think in any environment, like, you're closer to one person than you might be the other. And, you know, the biggest fear, I suppose, is sometimes that, you know, if these relationships then break down, it's the kind of that fear that then it then causes a bit of a weird vibe in the changing room. It can cause divisions, it can cause upset and a lot of distress. And I think, you know, it's the same in any kind of workspace. It's not just, I'm not just saying this is in women's football, but if you have a particularly turbulent breakup and then you've got to be in a position where you're seeing this person day in, day out, or even in a position where you're competing for this person's I don't know, position on the field day in, day out, yeah, it's a very it can cause a lot of turbulence. And I think it does depend on how you kind of navigate those spaces. But I think it was quite interesting what Helen was kind of saying, in that, you know, if you kind of have those conversations up front, if you're really open and honest with the changing room and with the manager about how you navigate some things that could turn up. I mean, she said that she spoke to her coach, Danny Kerry, and he was sort of the one who opened up the conversation about the relationship and how best they can kind of accommodate and facilitate it in a way that was not just, you know, well, this could go wrong, this could go wrong, this could go wrong. I do think I can understand completely Emma Hayes' comments that it does present challenges, and I don't think that you can ignore that.
Sure, but you could say the same about best friends, siblings. You know, there could be awkward situations in any relationship. I appreciate that, you know, being in a romantic relationship poses challenges too, but I just don't think that conversation is the one we needed to be having this week when the conversation was around player-manager relationships, which brings things in things like safeguarding and player welfare and power dynamics. And sure, it's a conversation that we can have, but it's also not unique to women's football. And, you know, it doesn't really matter what you do in life or what your job is. If you break up with the other half, it's shit. So, you know, and it will pose problems in all aspects of life. So I just think, yeah, the timing of that coming up and the, whether you know, from what she says, unintentional conflation of the two issues wasn't ideal.
No, agreed. Yeah, the timing wasn't great. And yeah, putting both things together is, I don't think that was the right space to do it and to approach that, especially I think not probably having had that conversation with the team prior to that kind of quite unexpected comments coming out. So yeah, timing not great, but could understand what she meant about challenges. And it's always good to know, I think, even for someone like Emma, who has done a million press conferences, who has always spoken on, you know, a lot of issues. And we've always rated the fact that she's been honest and she's absolutely put forward, you know, her opinions and how she feels about things. I think there was a kind of understanding and acknowledgement that, yeah, she'd got it wrong. And I think it was just nice to see someone say, yeah, I own it. And it wasn't the right thing to say. And I've had to have those discussions with the players. So, yeah, I think that was quite a nice thing to see as well. I mean, you've got to let people have mistakes and say the wrong things. Otherwise, you create a sort of situation where you will get press conferences where no one says anything at all and it all becomes very flat and mute. And there's not those kind of avenues to have more honest conversations about people having different opinions on things. Yeah, and having had a, you know, very successful relationship yourself, Rach, in the women's football space, working together day in, day out, like, absolutely. Like, it's one of those things you've got to navigate. I'm sure you and Soph have had your arguments and stuff in the past. I mean, Christ, never. I'm the third wheel in this relationship. And, you know, I would always try and support you in any way I can, lads. So, yeah, I've always got your back. Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
Thanks, Chloe.
Women's football weekend is upon us. There are a bunch of exciting fixtures, including the Women's National League final between Newcastle Lakeman and #United at Kenilworth Road. Yeah, did you like that?
Newcastle fans now know how I feel when Chloe does my accent.
I apologise for that. In fact, no, I don't apologise for that. I did my absolute best. The championship title race also continues with 1 point separating the top four in WSL. Isn't it? Isn't it exciting?
It was a five-horse race. Listen, I was at Cheltenham this week. I'm all about the horse racing right now.
Oh, I saw you gallivanting around on the race track.
I wasn't gallivanting. You're making it sound like I was jumping over the bloody jumps. They're massive.
You were. You and Soph were down there in your tweed barber jackets.
We weren't wearing tweed barber. There was a five-horse race in the championship for so long. And it's finally broken away to four now, I think. I do think Birmingham are kind of out of it now with the draw at the weekend. But Southampton, who look like maybe they're out of it, are very much back into it. Still in Palace's hands, but like with the way results are going, you're just so hard to call.
It's wild. So Sunderland are on 34 points, Palace are on 33, Charlton are on 33, and Southampton are on 33. Charlton and Crystal Palace have one game in hand. I actually think, and I'm gutted because I left Crystal Palace last year, literally on what could be the cusp of them going into the WSL, fuming, but also obviously really excited that could be a thing for them. And what I think for Laura Kaminsky to achieve in her first season as their manager, I mean, not to say I'm completely biased, but I am completely biased and I kind of hope they do it. It would be beautiful to see Palace in the WSL. As would it with any other team, but just personally for me, beautiful. In the WSL, we have two derbies, the first being Man City and United. I was going to do it. What's the Manchester United?
Don't. You've done the accent. You've done one accent. You're allowed one in an episode.
One per ep.
Yeah.
Okay. The first being Man City versus Man United. It feels too boring. At the Etihad on Saturday at 12:30. I mean, Rach, how do we see that going? They have met in the Conte Cup. Man City walked away with the win 2-1. They met in the league and Man City won. I mean, Man City look unbelievably strong despite being knocked out of the Conte Cup and the FA Cup, but they're 12 points clear of United. I think now that all those, you know, the competitions, they're all out of the way. Get them, they're like gnats flying around. Like just constant
so
distractions of silverware. You know, no one wants them. Like,
go away.
Yeah. Now, you've just got the WSL to fight for. Whereas Chelsea, as your WSL title contenders, the big ones, the Titans, the Goliaths, with a depleted squad, they've got barely anyone to field, but still winning because they've got that mentality monster type vibe about them. But they have got four competitions that they're still in. Their schedule is a chaotic whirlwind of a mess. Yeah, I mean, even like, I mean, they're taking on Ajax away tomorrow, and then they've got to then play a game at the weekend. And then the following week, they've got Ajax at home
again
on Wednesday, and then they've got another game at the weekend. And you're thinking, how much could a squad possibly sustain? This is the crunch time for Chelsea. This is the fear that I've got about where their season, either they plough through this muddy field of games or they get stuck in the mud.
This is what I said in the last pod. I was like, if Chelsea... excellent one. Loved it. Big fan of mud. If Chelsea win this season, if they manage to win multiple trophies, that it's... What makes it so impressive is the fact they've had to deal with this, the context around it, and it would make it probably their hardest season. And then someone like in the comments like started calling me a Chelsea fan, and we should call it Chelsea on the ball. And I was like, I'm just stating facts. Like, it is. The context is important. And I think sometimes... We look back over seasons and all you see is who won or who got Champions League and not the kind of context around it. Like we spoke a lot last season about the context around Arsenal's performances and how impressive they were with such a depleted squad. And I think the thing is, though... And
maybe you should have that on the WSL trophy. Chelsea
maybe,
won,
yeah.
Had a really depleted squad.
In brackets.
Their schedule was an absolute mess.
Yeah.
Their manager was about to leave.
ACL, 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 yeah.
Yeah, coming to it.
But Brian Sorensen said this at his... pre-match press conference where he was like, yeah, but when we talk about a depleted squad, like basically they're struggling to field 11 players. He said, when Chelsea do it against us, they brandish to bring on Mia Fischel and like Lauren James and leave Guro Wrighton on the bench. Do you know what I mean? And you're like, okay, yeah, that's a fair point. It's depleted for Chelsea. have to put that. But yeah, I just thought that was an interesting point that should they do it, they are fighting fires on four fronts. With what Chelsea would call a depleted squad.
So, do we think then that if... So, going into this weekend, Man City are facing Man United. If they win this game, I mean, it kind of feels like... I mean, I don't know. There's something about this game. I don't know what it is, but it just feels like this is the game that... could mean the most. And I mean there's still so many games they have to play, but there's just something about this game in particular that makes me feel like if they get this one, I think there's a heightened chance then that they'll get the title.
Well, when you look at the fixtures they have left, you know, they're going to single out the Man United game, the Arsenal game, as being the most difficult. So yeah, it is a big game. It's a derby. There's always something extra around a derby. I know we're going to come on to the Merseyside derby in a bit, but like both managers of those teams had said, form kind of goes out the window when you come into a derby, and so that can often make it quite tricky to call. I still think City will do it. I think they've been so consistent. I think we've seen them not play great at times and still win. But equally, you know, United have had some wins under their belt now, which might boost their confidence. They struggled against Bristol in terms of creating, and I think if you're not creating many chances against Man City and you've got Kiara Keating in goal, those few you do create need to be really bloody special. So I do think City should do it, but you also have to factor in there is going to be pressure on them because this is the only thing left to win, and they can't afford to drop points.
I'm more concerned about Chelsea beating West Ham than I am Man United beating Man City. I think Man City will win that game all day, whereas West Ham have posed disruption after disruption for top four sides quite a lot this season.
And not against the teams they should be beating.
I just kind of feel like West Ham could be that secret little spanner. They've done it before. I feel like if they do it again this weekend, that could really upset the apple cart. And I think it's Chelsea are in a vulnerable space. Like, despite getting a very comprehensive win against Arsenal, Arsenal were a bit of a mess. I don't think that was because, you know, Chelsea were absolutely phenomenal. Arsenal were a mess. And I think off the back of having this Ajax away game, having a depleted squad, going into this fixture and knowing West Ham are sticklers, it could happen. It could happen. I feel super excited. Anyway, let's get on to the other derby, the Merseyside derby up north.
Liverpool.
No? Stop it.
Let's do that.
Ah, Liverpool.
No, that's not it either.
Oh God. Right, I'm gonna park it.
Scouse.
Oh, you do it quite well. All right. Everton are hosting Liverpool at Goodison Park. Liverpool are, I mean, they've kind of been ones to watch. They've kept pace with Man United this entire season after they beat West Ham, and they're now level on 28 points. They've kind of, over the last five games, Man United and Liverpool have had the kind of same run of form. So three wins, a draw and a loss. The deciding factor is the goal difference, and Liverpool just don't score as many goals as Man United. But bar that, they're absolutely keeping level. I just think it's been quite a... we've not really talked too much about Liverpool.
It's going to be a really interesting weekend, because if Man United lose and Liverpool win, Liverpool will overtake them on points.
Yeah.
Which is wild.
Which I could 100% see happening.
Yeah.
I just think it's... they're kind of... I don't know, they just sort of quietly go about their business, Liverpool. No one's kind of seen them as kind of Champions League contenders or kind of like top spotters or anything like that. But they're also never talked about in the relegation battle, really. So they kind of sit in that kind of midsection of like safety. But I think, Everton beat Liverpool 1-0 Anfield in October. Goal scorer Megan Finnegan said after the game, "We wanted to cause mayhem." Mayhem.
That just sums up Everton's season, doesn't it?
Chaotic.
When I spoke to Brian Sorensen before the weekend on Friday, and he was like, yeah, this is the worst week for us. I had to bring a notebook so I didn't forget any of the players that we have out. And then he just went through like the longest list. It was like nine players or something. So the fact that, you know, they pulled out another performance the way that they did, you know, I find it really hard to call Everton games now, because every time I'm like, Everton are screwed. Oh God, Everton. And then they're like, no, it's okay. We're not going to be absolutely dominated. Like, yes, they lost to Aston Villa, but it was 2-1. Mm-hmm. They were in the game right to the death. So it's just going to be really interesting, because I think the added level of it being a derby gives Everton another thing to fight for when they're already fighting a lot this season. You've got players out of position. Don't know if you have any players in feckin' position, actually, but every week someone's playing a different position, and I really respect how they're still able to pull out performances. So I'm going to be at that game. I'm looking forward to it.
Oh my God, you're taking your mum? Is your mum back over?
My mum's gone home now, sorry.
Oh, mate. Oh, no box seats for her. All right, let's get stuck into kind of women's football weekend. We've had a question in from Jennifer. With the two derbies this weekend, what's the best rivalry in women's football right now? Do we
Chelsea
think...
Arsenal?
I don't know. I think it could change. Chelsea Man City. Like, I thought obviously them given the kind of the title race situation, I think Arsenal now out of it, kind of almost certain to kind of have the Champions League.
I just thought you meant
spot. Generally
in women's football, what is the biggest rivalry?
Oh yeah, I mean all day, like the Chelsea, like those games are always going to provoke the most amount of fans, the most amount of attention.
You can get those little tweets where they're like, they put up pictures of Arsenal's socks and go, "London is blue just like your socks." Like, you're not going to be able to get that between Man City and Chelsea. The rivalry there on the football pitch, amazing, so all exciting, day. Love those clashes. But for me, one of my favourites is Arsenal-Chelsea.
What creates the most amount of shithousery? Arsenal-Chelsea all day. So the Independent reported last week that WSL attendances are up 43% across the board this season, with more interest and more games at big stadiums. But the question that we kind of have is whether women's football weekend has become less relevant. Does it mean much to fans beyond the WSL's existing fan base? And I was pondering this last night, because I think like the whole reason or the kind of the genesis of Women's Football Weekend, and I just wanted to throw in a really smart word there, was that it was kind of a weekend dedicated to pushing women's football, to going to watch a women's game, to seeing it on telly, because it was the men's international break. So it was kind of like, men's football isn't on, why don't you go and give women's football a go? But it kind of feels like that's become a little bit of a redundant kind of not okay argument. I mean, when you look at the fact that Arsenal had just achieved two record-breaking attendances back-to-back on weekends where there was Premier League football going on, you kind of feel like it doesn't need that kind of, oh, well, you know, men's games aren't on, so come across and try your hand at women's football. Like, and also it has its own identity, it has its own fan base, it has its own audience of people who want to watch the game specifically. So I don't feel like there's anything different that the Women's Football Weekend title gives to the weekend.
I don't mind it. I think there should be moments in the season where they can identify opportunities to play multiple games across the weekend at the main stadia. If they can wrap the derbies into that, brilliant. I think finding, you know, whether you call it Women's Football Weekend or not, I think finding those opportunities is still key. We're not there yet. Like, bloody hell, I know the attendances are up. And a lot of those attendance figures are going to be massively increased by those games in big stadia that have drawn big crowds. So I do think it is still important that we can find these moments to shine a light on women's football. And like, even if you already are a fan, like, I'm going to do the Manchester derby on Saturday, then I'm going to do the Merseyside derby on Sunday, and then I'm going to go down to Villa Park and I'm going to watch Aston Villa play in Villa Park. Like, I'm going to get to be at three of these big stadiums in one weekend and see three big games. And that is quite exciting. You don't get to do that every weekend because a lot of games are on at the same time. So, you know, even if it was, I mean, maybe it's slightly different in the men's game in terms of you don't have as many fans that will go to multiple teams. You still have that in the women's game for some fans. And we're still growing the audience. And if it is an opportunity to bring more fans through the door, brilliant. It's also, you know, you can't pump as much money into the marketing all the time as you want to do. So it's another, I guess, window for them to say, right, loads of marketing here at this weekend. I'm sure there's going to be cool stuff being done around it, just to make people aware of the various games that are going on. And it's just another flashpoint to kind of shine a light. So, yeah, I don't really see an issue with it. I don't think it has any negative connotations. If some people aren't bothered about Women's Football Weekend, fine, they're still going to go to a game. But actually, I think it can still have an impact. And whether they decide to do away with the actual labelling of Women's Football Weekend, I still think going forward, having those opportunities where multiple games are in big stadia across the weekend, we should absolutely be doing.
I think I absolutely agree with your point. And I don't ever want to sort of shit on Women's Football Weekend parade. I'm all for advocating for, you know, time, space, sort of money investment being spent on, you know, highlighting women's football. I just think there's something about it that just feels like, do we need to kind of specifically highlight it for a weekend? And then sort of what's the impact of Women's Football Weekend? What is it, the sort of, what is the wider picture around it? I mean, I absolutely get that there's sort of, you know, let's pay attention to it for this weekend, but I don't want it to be, okay, well, just this weekend and then nothing else. Yeah. Sort of like, it's that. It doesn't, I don't want it to feel tokenistic in a way. And I think it's got to the point where actually, do we need it? Because I feel like the attention is generally consistently getting higher and higher, not just on a single weekend, but generally just across the board and for all types of fixtures. It's not just Arsenal-Chelsea, which is attracting massive crowds. It's Arsenal-Tottenham. Like, it's those kind of things. That for me feels like a bigger win than having something like Women's Football Weekend is my
Yeah,
my
no,
take.
I get that. But that's often individual club marketing, whereas this is an opportunity for more Barclays marketing and FA push around
absolutely.
It as well. So yeah, no, you're right. I don't want it to be tokenistic either. But I also think taking it away or not doing it.
Oh, no, I'd never advocate to take it away. My gosh, I'm not that savvy. I've got a heart. My God.
You're right, though. For the actual current fans, does it do loads? Probably not. But
no.
I still think it's a good opportunity.
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely more positive than it is anything else. So, yeah, advocate for it still to remain. Women's Football Weekend, just to clarify, everyone, it's still going ahead, as determined by Front. Right, Rach, I mean, you've kind of already said, like, where you're going to be this weekend, which is pretty much everywhere. I mean, how are you even finding the time to do all of this whilst eating, breathing and going to the loo? Like, I just don't
know
where
you're
fitting this.
I am going to Amsterdam tomorrow as well, so got to get that out of the way first to do Ajax Chelsea. Which will be fun because it's in the Johan Cruyff Arena, which I always call the Balmar Arena because that's what it was called when I lived there. So I've been there once. I'm excited to go again.
Oh my God, that's going to be amazing. I mean, I'm obviously going to be watching the Man United Man City game because that is just going to be the juiciest fixture. And I'm watching it kind of like, you know, like behind your duvet type vibe, like just like, oh my God, if I see a Man City goal go in within like the first 10-15 minutes, I'm not going to be okay. Like, there's ways and ways of losing. If you're going to lose, which I kind of suspect Man United might, do it. Please do it respectfully. Please. Right. And also, I've got to change around my WSL fantasy football thing as well. I've got Kiara Keaton, I think, currently. No, I've got Mary Earps currently as my goalkeeper. And I need to really figure out whether it's going to be Kiara Keaton in for my team this weekend or Earps. That's my biggest concern this weekend, actually. Right, on that note, I'm sure other people have far more important concerns for this week. Thank you for listening. In the meantime, you can find us on Instagram and Twitter. I am at Morgie_89. Rachel is at Girls on the Ball, and we are at Upfront Pod. You can also find us on YouTube at Upfront Pod. See you next week.
Upfront is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously,
man. Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.